Before we begin, have we got any Robot Wars fans in the audience? Shout me. Yay. So, little diversion in this is to make it make sense to those who maybe haven't watched Robot Wars. I was a judge on Robot Wars a while back, series 8 to 10. And it was the ones with Dara O'Brien and Angela Scanlon. And you can see here, this is the size of the pit. So when you see it on TV, the robots look about this big. Yeah, in real life, that's the pit, and you can get two or three one robot will bounce off the edges. And so that's the three judges. We've got Setu Vijayakumar, Noel Sharkey, and myself. So sort of bear that in mind as we go through. But it's the EMF special, so let's carry on. I don't know if you're like me, but do you get delight when you see a rainbow? When you see a butterfly flit past? When you see a shooting star? All these things bring me joy and wonder. And I've spoken about it before. There's a slight difference between awe and wonder. Wonder makes you think, how did that work? And awe makes you think, oh, let's all celebrate the wonder of the universe or the amazement of the universe. Doesn't matter which you have, as long as you get a little bit of joy out of it. So I wanted to find more joy in the sky. So I went around the world. I went around the world and I spoke to experts about things that were happening in the sky. So I've split the book up into the air, into the sky. So the air is everything around you that if you had a long enough stick, you could poke. But the sky is stuff that even if you had a really long stick, you couldn't poke it. And then above that, we've got space. So to start with, one of the things that I really wanted to see when I was traveling around the world was this. Are we running? Not yet. There we go. Now, I don't know if you can see what I'm looking at here. These are all butterflies. And every year, millions and millions of butterflies all congregate on five or six hills in Mexico and overwinter. So I wanted to go here and see all these butterflies coming and thinking, wow, wouldn't that be amazing just to be standing amongst all these butterflies as they're flying past? So this was on my list of things I should go and see, find the science about, and then put in the book. I mean, the book was a bit of an excuse to go around the world. Don't tell my publishers. So yes, all these butterflies. Now we don't usually have these in the UK. They're called monarch butterflies. They're about the same size as my palm. And they don't just do this amazing thing of congregating in Mexico. Some of them migrate 3,000 miles to get there. So they travel all the way down from almost Canada and get down into Mexico. So it's like, how do they do that? How do they know how to get there? How do they know what they're doing? So I spoke to the scientists, Monarch Watch, and they said, yeah, come talk to us. So I went to Monarch Watch. It's in Kansas, in the States. And they said, right, we've got a whole open day. This is the different stages. So I don't know. I've never seen a caterpillar, a butterfly, come out of its chrysalis before. It's really amazing. Apparently, it's a really common thing if you live where monarchs are, but in the UK, I've never seen it. And so they come out of their chrysalis, and you can see their body's really fat, and then you just see the body pumping for a bit, and the wings get bigger and bigger until they're just butterflies. And so I said, how do you know that these butterflies are going 3,000 miles? How do you know this? And they said, oh, we tag them. You tag butterflies? Thing around the ankle. How do you tag butterflies? Oops. You catch them. So I've given a net running through the fields trying to catch these butterflies. And then you stick a sticker on it. It's a sticker with a unique number. And then you log your number and you let your butterfly go again. And then people in Mexico look around. Now, when they overwinter, quite a high percentage of these butterflies die. So people are going round under these trees looking for these stickers, and they're paid for a sticker. So they have to find butterflies with stickers, basically. And that's how they've been doing it for the last 20 years. And I say, oh, wouldn't it be so much easier if they, you know, could put an electronic tag on it? And they said, yeah, we've been asking that for years. In fact, you know, we've got a quote from 1996. We're waiting for the day when we can do this. And you know, when I was there, yeah, it was still in the writs of sci-fi. Until during lockdown, someone got asked, could you build a transmitter light enough for a monarch butterfly? So, sorry, a bit before 2015, but during lockdown, there was a lot of bored people. So this coin's about the size of a 10-pence piece. The long thing's the antenna. The little black things are solar panels. And they stick these on butterflies. So a butterfly, one of these monarchs, is about 60 milligrams. It's about 0.6 grams. So that's about 30 grains of rice. That's how heavy this butterfly is. The transmitter is 60 milligrams, so about 3 grains of rice. So it's the equivalent for the butterfly. I didn't do that. There we go, they're sticking the sensor on the butterfly, and they stick it with eyelash glue. Anyway, they put these sensors on, and it's about the equivalent, you know, your hand luggage when you go through through the airport, and usually you can take about 7 kilos, and many people are about 70 kilos, so it's like, you know, one of those hand luggage on your back for a butterfly who's then got to travel 3,000 miles. But they've been doing it. And I've only discovered this since the book came out, so this isn't in the book, this is, you know, an extra. And they've been following these butterflies, because they were like, will it work? And yes, it does. And they're finding all sorts of science out from this data. And it's effectively like an air tag on the butterfly. And so when its wings are open, the solar panel gets power, or the solar panel gets the power from the sun, pulses the transmitter, and if it's going past someone's phone, just like an air tag, the phone sends the message on, and they get all this data. And they're actually finding They can track this with the weather and say, oh yeah, there was a thermal here, it was very cold then, and they've managed to you know, actually track these with the weather. More of these are making it than they thought butterflies would make, that would do it without the little rucksack on. I don't think it's the rucksack that's helping them. So that was one place, but we can track these too. So I went to Monarch Watch, which was up in Kansas, and they bought some of these. They were about $100 each. So they were a little bit too expensive to, you know, put on every butterfly, but they put them on quite a few. And so they traced them all the way down. And then February, March time, not only did the same butterfly go all the way down, it overwintered, basically it hibernated, And then they start coming back up again, and they lay their eggs en route coming back up. So these little butterflies are making it all the way up and down. Can we do the Q&A later, please? Thanks. Right. Plug, book, nice book. So I have got a little reading for you, so you know what's, you know, what it's about. So my first chapter, the first part is all about things in the air, includes the butterflies. And then I've got things in the sky, and it includes clouds. I still take pleasure from seeing shapes in the fun and fair weather cumulus clouds, but they can grow taller and taller to become something much more menacing and beautiful, the cumulonimbus cloud. Though we've already come across it in our exploration of the different types of cloud, it is such a behemoth that it deserves a chapter all to itself. You might see behemoth has got a capital B. My editors didn't like it. But I continue. In the UK, only a few tornadoes occur each year. These usually cause damage, such as taking tiles off roofs and relocating trampolines, but are rarely as devastating as those in other parts of the world. If I were judging tornado, I would use the criteria of damage, aggression, and control. However, in the UK, the official measure is the TORO, or T scale, which is directly related to the Beaufort scale, used to measure wind speed. The higher the number, the higher the wind speed. So I might have got a little few Easter eggs, and this is the audience that I wrote that for, so thank you to Mark Mellors for suggesting it. They are in there, and I had such a pain to get it past the copy editors. But another little book, another little part of that same chapter. My voice is squeaky, my breathing shallow, and my throat is tight. I am scared. I try to laugh it off. Others have assessed the danger and are okay with the current risk. But I have less experience, and importantly, an option to escape. The clouds above me are a washed-out black jeans kind of grey. In front of me, a field of yellowing grass is bent almost double. The wind roars. My shirt flaps wildly. Beyond the yellow grass is a recently harvested field, hay bales dotted amidst the pale green. And rising from the pale green is a solid wall of off-white cloud, turning to darker grey in the middle. It looks like this wall is smashing into the dark grey clouds above, tearing them apart and leaving ragged clumps suspended in a freeze frame of falling. This is a supercell, a powerful thunderstorm, rare in most places, but more common here in America's Tornado Alley. Flash! The afterimage divides my vision, jagged and almost vertical, like a paper tear. Almost immediately, I feel, rather than hear, the thunder. This is not the rumble of a summer storm in the UK. I'd heard supercell thunder described as a cannonball bouncing down a wooden staircase. That is an understatement. It's a giant cannonball bouncing down a giant's wooden staircase. The echo reverberates inside me. Dry grass cracks under my feet as I stumble back across the dirt and gravel track and launch myself up and into the back seat of the SUV, pulling the door hard to shut it against the wind. As I catch my breath, relatively safe in my own Faraday cage, I see smoking rising in a far field. That strike ignited the grass. Now I'm going to shout out to a few more people at EMF camp, because The images in the book were done by Rob Ives, and you might be able to go to his workshop on Sunday. And also in the book, there's a shout out to DJ Tufty. And this time tomorrow, she'll be they'll be in the in Null Sector, doing a DJ set. So I'm now going to tell you a story that didn't make it into the book, slightly more storytelling. Long, long time ago, when our star, the sun, was still quite young, there was swirling and whirling around rocks and rubble and grit and gas and glittering ice. And they were whirling and swirling and bumping and crashing until they sort of coalesced together to make spheres. And as they got larger and larger, they became the planets. But even after all the big planets were formed, there was still some gas and glittering ice and grit swirling and whirling about, and these also came together, coalesced into to balls, and they became bigger and bigger. They didn't become the size of the planets, they were about the size of a city. Now, we probably know, everything in our solar system goes around the sun. So we've got the sun here and the planets, Mercury up close, 88 days, Neptune way, way out here, 76 years it takes to go around. And our gritty, city-sized, dirty snowballs, they also went round. Time passed. And during that time, the big pull of the planets pulled and teased at the smaller snowball-sized spheres, and they changed their orbit. So instead of going in nice circular orbits, some of these, one in particular we keep our eye on, would come right in near the distance of Mercury, but then it would go all the way out to Neptune and out beyond the orbit of Neptune before coming all the way back. Time passed. On the Earth, eyes evolved and looked up. They could see a star with a hairy tail. Time passed. Humans evolved, and when they looked up, they saw a star with a hairy tail. Now, people, whenever they saw one of these stars with a hairy tail, they named it the hairy-tailed star, Comet. And so these comets, whenever someone saw them, they would make stories. It would touch their hearts, and it stayed in their stories for all time. In ancient Babylon, they saw the comet, and they said it was a message from the gods. The Chinese, they saw a comet, and they wrote on their bamboo and their silk that all the details about it. 2,000 years ago, there were three men, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and they looked up in the sky, and there was a comet in the sky. 1,000 years ago, there was a comet above the Solent, and everyone had different interpretations. The British looked up and said, oh, doom and gloom. The French, it's a prophecy of glory. So the French invaded and they won. And they made to celebrate this giant tapestry, which you can now see in the UK. And in it, you can see this comet above the soldiers. In 1705, there was an astronomer who was looking through all the tables, because astronomers are very good at writing details down, and realized that this comet that was seen once, he thought it would be seen, it was seen previous to that and previous to that, and so therefore predicted that it would come again. Now, he died before it did, but when it did, they named it after him, Halley's Comet. Now, you may know it as Halley's Comet. So there's debate about it. The astronomers prefer Halley's, but if you're more into shake, rattle, and roll, you'll probably know it as Halley and his comets. By 1986, when it came back again, humans had developed spaceflight. And so they sent up spacecraft to see what's inside, this giant ball that we can see. And the Europeans sent something up, sent Giotto up, the USSR sent Vega, and the Japanese sent Suisei. And they got up and they all sent their photos back down. And they said, it's a giant, burnt potato. That's what it looks like. Now, comets don't care for kings, conquerors, for scientists and storytellers. They are older. They are older than the pyramids. They will continue after us. They are in the life of a comet. Empires rise and fall. The pyramids weather. Cathedrals are built, are burnt, are built again. And this is just a flash in that life of the comet. There's the flickering firelight in the vast night, and the comet will return again and again and again. It is like a heartbeat in the sky. Now, currently, Halley's Comet, is out beyond the orbit of Neptune, but it's coming back. And in about 35 years' time, if you're standing out at night, you might actually see Halley's Comet. But if you do, remember all those people who have seen it before you, all those eyes that have looked up and written it on their bamboo, made it into stories, prophecies of glory or doom and gloom. Because once you have seen Halley's Comet, you become part of the story that started long before the Earth had oceans and will continue long after our fires go out. Thank you.